Hello. It's on. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the last panel of the day. Woo-hoo. It's kind of odd that it's called a panel since it's only me, but I am sort of a multiple personality guy. So maybe we can make it into more of a panel if afterwards we do some Q&A and talk about some of the discussion, make it a really big panel. Maybe that would be good. I'm Jim Koodall from Koodall Partners in Chicago. I'm going to tell you just a little bit about our company as a little bit of background for where all this is coming from. And we can talk about any of these issues afterwards as well if you have any questions or not. We're a fairly conventional, one part of us is a fairly conventional design consultancy, design and advertising consultancy in Chicago. We're small. There's only seven of us. We do the things that normal design firms do. We make TV spots and design billboards and name products and services and do brochures and websites and all of that. But a bigger part of what we do is a number of things that we've created for ourselves. Have created and run a couple of retail brands. The best known one, I guess, is Jewelboxing, jewelboxing.com, where we sell a custom kit for creative professionals to make short-run, high-end DVD and CD packaging. We have another brand that we're working on now with Aaron Draplin from Portland, Oregon, called Field Notes brand. And our first product for Field Notes is a small little made in the USA memo book that sort of harkens back to 30s and 40s and Midwestern American design, like farmers planting books and those sort of things. So we're starting to crank that up. Beside the retail products, we run something called The Deck. The Deck is a targeted ad network. It's targeted basically at you, at creative, web, and design professionals. It's made up of 25 sites and serves up tens of millions of impressions every month. The sites in it are A List Apart, Found, Daring Fireball, Kotke, The Morning News, Design Observer, Koodall, Swiss Miss, Waxy, and lots of other ones. We do something sort of different things with The Deck. We're sort of different than other ad networks in that we only serve up a single ad on any page view, and it's not very big. We won't take an ad from an advertiser unless we've paid for and/or tried or appreciate their product or service. And we try to keep our hands out of the PowerPoint-dominated media world where people create big presentations about demographics and stats that are lies to try to sell advertising. We keep it pretty lo-fi. If you want to buy a slot on The Deck, you buy for a month and you get a percentage of all the impressions against all the sites in the network. And it works pretty well for all three of the parties involved. The publisher gets a relatively small vetted ad for a real product that's really relevant to their audience, without animation and without Punch the Monkey and all that. The reader gets to continue to read the independent publishers who are making some money from the publishing they're doing, but also gets to see ads that, in fact, are relevant. And the advertiser gets a large, savvy, influential, targeted audience who in an uncluttered environment is the only ad on the page. So that works pretty good. We can talk about that later if you want. And then we also have Koodall.com. And on Koodall.com, we run sort of a regular link list, fresh signals, and we get a lot of traffic to that. And the whole site's fairly popular. But we do a lot of projects, and we do a lot of contests and films. And I'll talk about one project just for a second. We recently finished the first season of what was called Layer Tennis, which is an online design competition. I think some of the Layer Tennis players from the first season are here, or commentators anyhow. And it is a competition that took place live on 15 Friday afternoons. And two artists, illustrators, animators, photographers, designers, whoever, two invited artists would trade a file back and forth and continue to update it in real time. So if I was playing against you, I would put up an image, and then you'd have 15 minutes to embellish or add to that image, and you'd have to put up your volley, and then you'd send it back to me, and then I'd do it again. We'd do it 10 times. We'd have a third person, usually a blogger or a writer or an editor, crack wise about it and doing play-by-play commentary. And then we'd have forums for people to discuss it. And we decide on a winner and we go on to the next week. So Layer Tennis is very popular. Millions of views of Layer Tennis over the 15 weeks. And we're working on next year, this year's season, in which we'll do more matches and also have this idea of allowing anybody to sort of play their way into the tournament. So more on that to come. Anyhow, that's what Kudal Partners is. But today's presentation really isn't about that, except that doing those things like, you know, writing the blog and creating ads and making films has allowed us, we've been lucky enough to be able to do a lot of quote-unquote day-to-day creative work in a lot of different fields. And when I came up with this idea for this presentation of a general theory of creative relativity, I really was going to do just like a big send-up of pop science, like just make the whole thing sort of tongue-in-cheek, figured it's the end of the day, it'll be good for a laugh. And maybe it will still be good for a laugh. Maybe it is all stupid. But we'll see. We'll see together. But actually, as we started to evaluate this joke, it became less funny and sort of more interesting. So I don't know where that leaves us exactly, but we'll see how it goes. You're never supposed to start a presentation with a disclaimer, so I'm going to start with two. The first is that when I was a little kid, I wanted to be an architect, and then I found out how much math there was involved in structural engineering, so I bailed. And after that, I wanted to be an astronomer, and I found out how much math there was in physics, so I bailed. And I wound up in advertising design where there's hardly any math at all. So me talking about physics, which I'm going to do a little bit in this, is like ridiculous. So if somebody can prove me wrong, I'm all for it. And the second disclaimer is that this is a general theory of creative relativity, not a universal one. So I'm talking about the creativity that we all run into in our day-to-day jobs. If we're making films for people, or we're building websites, or we're building web apps, or we're writing copy, or we're art directing ads, or we're writing music for a film, or whatever it is, the day-to-day sort of work, and how do we sort of identify that? The idea of presenting this theory is, if we can examine how things happen in the creative process, it doesn't mean it's going to make it easier, but it might make it easier to understand, and it might make it better, easier to be better. And it might even make us less cynical, which would be something. Certainly around my office, it would be something. So this theory is in three pieces, and well, here it goes. The first part of the theory of this formula, and it's not really like E equals MC squared or anything, but it's sort of like that. But the first part of this formula is, when we evaluate a work of art, like a movie or a record, it's very difficult for us to get to the heart of what the creative process is, because there's a lot of other moving pieces. There's the cinematography, there's the editing, there's the soundtrack, there's the acting, there's the directing. It's very difficult to get at the heart of the creative process, of the creative event, for lack of a better term. So I'm going to suggest that we here talk about a little experiment that can serve as sort of a laboratory for us, that can exist in a creative assignment, that can exist in a vacuum, so we can sort of look at it and try to see what happens to make the creative thing happen, to make the creative event happen. Where is it? What is it? It's not like, it just doesn't come from heaven. And so a while back, Susan, who works as one of the partners at Kudal Partners, came in over the weekend, and she painted all the walls in our bathroom with chalkboard paint and got some boxes of chalk. And I would recommend that to anybody who works in a collective environment, in a firm where people go to the bathroom. And you know, in our firm, we spend way too much time on the computer talking to each other via IM, even when we're right next door. So it is sort of ironic that we crack all our jokes when we're in the bathroom by ourselves, but that's a whole other story. But anyhow, we use the chalk on the wall. People who visit us tend to leave messages on the walls, and we play word games and hangman and stuff, so you come in and guess a letter, and then the next time you come in, you can guess another one. It's excellent. But one of the things that somebody started, Brian Bedell, who's one of our art directors, he started this thread that later became known on our website as Booking Bands. And what Booking Bands was is a really simple but fun and addictive word game. And Booking Bands was, all you have to do is combine the title of a book with the name of a band and try to make it sort of funny. So Horton hears a hoobastank, or the who moved my cheese, or the old man and the sea and cake, or Dexy's Midnight Kite Runners. It goes on forever, and they're all over our website. So just think about, right now, just start to think about a couple of them. I mean, don't get totally distracted by it, but try to think of a couple of them because it's important. I'm going to use this as the laboratory experiment for the first part of the general theory of creative relativity. So are you thinking, is anybody thinking one? Anybody got like Charlie Daniels in the Chocolate Factory yet or anything? Okay, so you're thinking of it. Okay, so now I know how you're thinking about it. Without a doubt, I know how you're thinking about it. And this is where we're gonna get to it. This is sort of quantum mechanics. Here we go into physics, so this could really be effed up. But this represents the most elemental particle of the creative process, right? So you're thinking of the booking bands. Anybody got one? Say it. There you go. Steve, that's Steve Perry back there, ladies and gentlemen. All right, so you're thinking of it, and here's how you're thinking of it. You are either temporarily holding a book title in your mind while with the rest of your mind you are reeling through band titles trying to find something that works together with the book title. Or conversely, you are holding a band title. Maybe you're a Bananarama fan. And you're holding a band title in your head, and you are reeling with the rest of your mind through all the books that you know, trying to find something that works with that. You are not randomly picking a book and a band, because the chances of those working together in any fun or entertaining way. And since this is a scientific experiment, let's back up 1 second. Let's first of all state what we're trying to prove with this experiment. With this booking band's mind experiment, you are trying to combine the title of a book with the name of a band to come up with an interesting or entertaining new thing. Okay? So that's how you're doing it. And you're certainly not randomly picking numbers because you have nothing to base it on. And I'm going to maintain, let's see, I'm going to make the theory that this process that you're using right now to do this booking bands, and maybe here's the deal. If you ask a question later, you want to ask a question later, you got to start with a booking band. So we'll start that. But this process that you're going through by putting the band and the book together, and once you get started, you can't stop, that is the elemental moment of the creative process. That moment, and it is what it is on an atomic level, there is a variable and there is a constant. So if you've got They Might Be Giants in your head, that's the constant. And all the names of all the other books that have the word they and might and giants in them go around, and you come upon the book, the things they carry. And that's the variable. When you put them together, that's the creative act. That's the things They Might Be Giants carried. When you put them together. It's not the two things together. It is the association about them. It's the force that binds the known and the unknown together. So that is the elemental, I'm going to maintain in my pseudoscientific way, that is the elemental thing in the creative process. As we approach it, is this the known and the unknown, the constant and the variable, and the association is the action. That is the creative event. Now, okay, it works for booking bands, but like with any scientific experiment, at some point you've got to zoom back out and see how it works in other places and think about it, and we can talk about it later. I think it actually holds up pretty well. Not to get all English literature on you, but I did go to get a major in that, so once in a while I got to talk about it to make it feel like I paid all the tuition for something. Joseph Conrad's Heart of Darkness and Henry James' What Maisie Knew are two great novels for a million reasons. But elementally, most importantly, the reason that they're great novels is because of this idea of the constant and the variable, the known and the unknown. Both of these novels take as the known, as the constant, a pretty typical Western narrative. Heart of Darkness is the hero's journey into the unknown, and What Maisie Knew is basically a domestic drama between a husband and wife who are having trouble. But the variable is, for both Conrad and for Henry James, is that they've decided to tell these stories in a completely new way. That they're not telling them like an omniscient narrator saying he did this and she said that and he shot him, but they are moving the narrator into the mind of one of the characters. And more important than that, that character who is now telling us the story, we are reading the words through their eyes, through Maisie's eyes. We're reading it through their eyes. That person is unreliable. This is a whole new thing in literature when these books were written. And Mrs. Dalloway is like that, and by Virginia Woolf and other books. But that's the known and the unknown, the constant and the variable. And I can't make any presentation ever anywhere without talking about Stanley Kubrick, so I'll just talk about Barry Lyndon now. And Kubrick's movie, Barry Lyndon, the constant's easy to identify. It's Thackeray's novel of Redmond Barry as he grows up and goes through the class system of England and pretends and acts to be all these different things, and how he attempts to find himself in this story. And the variable is the way that Kubrick has decided to film this thing. He shoots it with modern techniques like zoom lenses and not so modern techniques like shooting only with available light in order to paint a series of 2D photos that are almost indistinguishable from the paintings of Thackeray's time in some ways. So that is the known and the unknown. And to make it really more obvious, take The Clash. The known is the punk rebellion of the time and sprinkled in with a little bit of ska, with a little bit of Caribbean influence. And then add in this variable, which is this naive but fervid global political awareness, and put it together and you have Sandinista. So now I've got Henry James sitting with Stanley Kubrick and Joe Strummer. So that's a pretty good three anyhow, so at least for me. So maybe this works. So, okay, the first part of the general theory of creative relativity is there is a variable and a constant, and finding the association between those two things is the act, is the actual thing, X times Y or whatever it is. All right, so now there's two other parts. The second part of this is about sort of the ignition, about if that's quantum mechanics, this is the Big Bang. But before that, a lot of you probably do work internally or externally for other people, and you find it difficult to price your services. And one of the reasons it's really difficult to price your services is because you have two jobs. You have A and B. They're identical assignments for two different clients. And A is a pain in the ass. It takes 3 weeks. You do 1,000 iterations, 1,000 revisions. You get into arguments. You start over again. And finally, through sheer force of will, you come up with the creative answer and you present it, and you're woefully underpaid for the work you did. And B is the same exact assignment for another client, and you have the idea when you're driving through a toll booth. So how do you price the two things, and how do we value those two things? I think maybe that's where I'm going with this general theory of creative relativity, is that maybe if we know, I mean, you can't build a business on driving through toll booths, so, you know, maybe if there's a way to understand the process better, we can find a way to systematize it, although I don't entirely believe that myself, but that's part of this shtick, I guess. Anyhow, so. All right, the second part of it, you know what I'll do is I'm going to show this. The second part of it, oh man, I'm just going to show this movie and then we're going to talk about it, because this is kind of about the second part of it. But that is not permitted. All right, hold on, I'm sorry. Something's happening.
Find a good spot to watch spastic rocks. They just hop. They just hop. I got a million.
Sorry, I thought I had it on the menu. Oh, boy. Okay. This movie is by Steve Delahoy. He's one of the partners at Kudal Partners. It's from his series called Regrets. And might not be obvious why it's included, but it will be afterwards.
Oh, boy. Well, that's like a goose or something. I think that's a goose. I'm pretty sure that's a goose. Yep, that's a goose. I mean, or a duck. I have no idea what I'm looking at.
This is just like, you know, I do this all the time.
You know, I get in, way too involved.
You know how I probably started on the bus and I saw some poster about bird watching or heard something on the radio about bird. Or just, you know what, I probably just saw a bird. You know, and then I thought, hey, I have a propensity for this. I'm a bird watcher.
I am, got the vest, you know, got the binoculars.
Look like Audubon himself. Whereas a normal person would see a bird and they'd say, oh, look at that, a bird. I'll go back to my life now. Not me. It's not like I'm OCD or anything like that. I don't have to lick all the clothes I have before I put them on.
I think I just really enjoy, maybe it's just that I get real hyped up about new activities. And then I realize, oh, this thing that I've become horribly interested in is really boring. I mean, bird watching. This is ridiculous. Standing around, why don't I... let's hunker down and find a good spot to watch spastic rocks. They just hop. They just hop.
I got a million examples. The train, you know, model trains.
I decide I'm going to get into model trainery. But instead of actually investigating model trains, which gauge,
kind of locomotive I wanted, I decided that I should spend all my time and effort
trying to locate the greatest engineer's hat. You know, the striped one with the blue, they're kind of got a, they got a little bill.
Day and night. On the internet, on the phone, calling all over the country, trying to find this hat.
My wife, she kind of gets fed up with it. She says, well, since you're interested so much in model railroad, maybe you should get a model railroad. And I try to cover up. I go, I already just found the right one. So I go to some hobby shop and just grab some piece of shit. So I get home and I just slap the whole thing together, put it on a piece of plywood in the middle of the garage. It doesn't work. Of course it doesn't work, because I don't know what I'm doing. And so she comes in and she says, this is just like all the other stuff you get interested in. And I go, no, what are you? She goes, what's that? She points to this orange traffic cone that I have in the middle of the track. She goes, well, what's that? I go, that's the mountains. That's scenery. See, I care. I'm going to do this forever. I mean, of course she was right. And that stuff just sat there in the garage until I got interested in some other fucking thing like horse photography or something.
Skydiving lessons.
Rock climbing. It just never ends. The dog breeding.
Apparently I was supposed to feed them more. They got really fucking aggressive.
Stamp collecting. That's a thrill. You got to touch them with tweezers.
Guess how many caves I've been in? None. But I have a closet full of spelunking gear if you're interested. Christ, I'm just a fucking idiot.
It's ridiculous. You know what, though? Forget it. You know what? No, I'm not. I'm sit down, and I am going to wait for the birds to return. This is something I enjoy. This is my new passion.
Honey, I'm going bird watching again. Again, this is the first in a series of my bird watching experiences. That's what this is.
Okay, I'm going to find out where to find a ruddy turnstone.
I'm not going to start surfing.
Nope.
Collect antique pistols, you know, those dueling pistols in those sweet wooden boxes with the... Nope. Not that, you know, the frequency, the guys on the radio that talk on that, well, they have their own frequency, then they sit down in their basements and they, you know, they, come on, what is it? Ham radio. That sounds cool, though, doesn't it? I think they have, like, you have to have special headphones. Shit. Birds, I'll not interrupt you anymore. Enjoy your privacy.
So that's a yay, Steve. There's a whole series of films he made called Regrets. You can get to them through our site. That is sort of bittersweet, the film. And you sort of, I don't know about anybody else, but I see an awful lot of myself in that guy. And I talked about this last year when I presented at South by Southwest with Brendan Dawes a little bit. And I've thought about it a lot more. And I think it's easy to this guy to beat up himself, and his wife is upset with him too, maybe. But I sort of think totally and completely the opposite. I think that this short attention span must be obeyed and may not be denied. That moment of passion, that initial moment of enthusiasm about a new idea or a new concept, that very first thing, that is the juice. That is the shit. That is what's important. When we talk about the general theory of creative relativity, that is what amplifies the first thing we talked about, the unknown and the known, that action there. This is the amplification of it. You know, we sometimes think that the creative thing, and it's nice, sort of attractive to think that the creative thing is like St. Paul walking by the side of the road and getting hit by lightning. Or like James Joyce talks about the consciousness of the Irish race appearing to a guy all at once in one transplendent moment, an epiphany. But it's not like that at all, I don't think. In fact, I don't think it comes from outside at all. I think it comes from inside. I think that the moment of, I don't know what we could call it, the wrong thing to call it, but the sort of moment of divine intervention, you know, is the spark of the divine doesn't come from the outside. It comes from the inside. And it comes like that guy's eyes when he starts talking about ham radio. It comes with that moment of greatest enthusiasm and curiosity. If I had a guitar right here and I played a chord on the guitar, and then we looked at the waveform of the chord, it would start out really big where the note is attacked. And as the sustain and decay went out, that waveform would get smaller and smaller. But why can't I have this and this and this and this? Why can't I have the full waveform? Why can't get the stuff, the juice, every time over and over again? That's what we're about. That's what we have to go. And it's okay if you don't want to do horse photography after you've fallen in love with it. It's a lot easier to fall in love than it is to stay married. You know, you want to engender this. And I think as the second part of this theory is, you know, from to go back to physics a little bit, and here I'm way in over my head, but the actual theory of relativity equals mc squared. I believe that the c squared, the c is the speed of light. And so c squared is a big ass number. And what it means in relativity, if you extrapolate the whole thing, is this tiny little ball of fissional material can blow up Nagasaki. That is what that C squared means, that difference. And in a way, this flash of enthusiasm, this flash of curiosity, this divine spark from within, this is the thing that amplifies that association we made when we were looking at the booking bands experiment. So we said, okay, I'm going to find a related or unrelated association between two things, and now I'm going to blow it up because I have this amplifier of my enthusiasm for the idea. So that's part two, I guess. So part two. And to say only one more thing about that is that I know this is true because I know a lot of people who do creative work, and everybody loves to do their application of craft. They love to do the layouts, and they love to finish the coding. They love to execute the job. But all of them will say, without fail, that moment when they had the idea, when they found that association between the known and the unknown, the moment they had an idea, those are the words that everybody says, I live for that. That is the moment. That's the real deal, Stan. You know, that is the moment that we get our satisfaction from. So if we can have more of that, we're going to be happier, and we're going to be maybe less cynical. You know, Elliot Smith and Vincent van Gogh notwithstanding, I think in our business, you're generally going to do more satisfying good work as a relatively happy person than you are full of despair and loneliness. Just my thought, but I think that perhaps you are. And before I go to the third part of the theory, there's one other thing, or a couple of things. One thing is that there's nothing more terrifying than the blank page. We've all heard that before. You know, you sit down, you got something to do, and you're sitting looking at that fucking checkerboard in Photoshop, or you're, you know, popping open the Illustrator thing, or you've got your memo pad in front of you, or a text document that you need to fill in. And there's nothing more terrifying than that. And that's why, as creatives, we are constantly looking for rules and restraints and grids and things like that. We're trying to limit ourselves in some way, because once we're limited, we can bump up against those limits in a way, and we can start to solve the problem. But when anything is possible, quite frankly, nothing is possible. It's terrifying. And the other end of the spectrum, if you take that all the way to the end of the project, is how the hell do we know when we're done? When do we know when to leave well enough alone? When do we need to know when to leave well alone? You know, Truman Capote was a serial reviser. He was a procrastinator, and it was always late, but he was also a reviser. He revised everything over and over and over again. Nothing was ever good enough for him. And when he was asked how he knew when he was done with a novel, he said that it was easy. It's when that guy from the publishing company comes to my apartment and takes the pages. And that's sort of the opposite of this. So we have this tyranny of the blank page, and we have this intimidation of it never being good enough. And all of it can be addressed, or at least made easier, if we try to understand the process more. So maybe that's what I'm doing today. I don't know. So we've got a constant and a variable, an unexpected or expected association between a constant and a variable, blown up or amplified by this rush of enthusiasm, by a well-trained short attention span. And then the last part of this theory that was supposed to be funny, but maybe isn't very funny, but is sort of interesting, is that many times we need now to communicate this thing. We've got this idea, and it's powerful, but it's in a raw form, and it's difficult to communicate. So I'm going to call the part that comes under the line in the formula, if the formula is x, y times infinity or something, under the line is like to the third power. And like to the third power is a way to explain, a creative way to attack a communication problem. And rather than try to explain it all as once, I'll explain it in pieces because I think it makes more sense that way. Like to the first power is the power of metaphor. This thing is like this thing. We do it all the time when we're trying to explain something in our daily conversation. If we have an idea that is convoluted or unexpected or new, the easiest way for us to explain it to somebody is to find something that it's like and say it's like this. It's like in the movies when they say, oh, this is going to be a great movie. It's Die Hard meets Mary Poppins or whatever the hell it is. And so that's the idea is that we're using a metaphor to explain it. Or we might say, I solved problem A in this manner, and here I am with problem B. Perhaps I can use, not steal the answer, but use the way that I solved this problem as a way to get at solving this problem. Or, let's say you're stuck in a layout or for a logo or a design, one way that frequently helps is to sit somewhere and just flip through award books. I do this all the time. And I'm not trying to steal layouts, although I'm sure people are not above that in general, but what I'm doing is I'm not even looking at the ads and the other people's work as much as I'm looking through them to the way in which those people successfully solved a different problem. I'm looking to see, I want to see how they did it, what they did, what it was like for them to do it. So that's part of the metaphor too. So the first power of like to the first power is like as metaphor. The second is my 10-year-old daughter, Isabel, on the phone saying, and I was like, oh my God. And he was like, I can't believe you did that. And I was like, duh. And that is a completely different thing, but equally powerful. That is what Isabel's doing there, what we all use the word for, really. What she's doing there is doing an executive summary. Like, whatever comes after like is going to be summarized in a way that the person that I'm talking to can understand it. For example, when she says, I was like, duh. And, you know, it does break your heart as a dad to hear your daughter say that, by the way. But when she would say, I was like, duh, what she could have said was, I was surprised at the obviousness of your response, Billy. And knowing that you and I share a social milieu, you should have been aware that it would have been so obvious yourself. But instead she said, I was like, duh. It means the same. So it's a really powerful shorthand, like as summary. Somebody at lunch, we were talking about this at lunch yesterday, and somebody said, yeah, you don't even have to talk after it. You can say, I was like. Now, if I wanted to say that in language, I would say, I was torn between two options, but being put on the spot froze me and I couldn't make a decision. Or I could say, I was like, I don't know. So it's sort of interesting. So that's like as summary. And the third like, and I think maybe these are all equally important, is the more obvious one where I have this thing and this thing in front of me and I like this one better, an aesthetic judgment. And we use that power of like all day long in our work, even when we're not comparing two things, we're actually comparing something to some mythical great thing. I don't like that brown so well and I swap it out for blue. I'm not actually comparing brown to blue. I'm moving through a series of aesthetic decisions. And that's very powerful at Kudal Partners. And I've talked about this before, is as we're looking to work with somebody or maybe hire somebody or looking at interns or whatever, we are happy to look at talent and excited to look at technical skill, but none of it works if we don't have taste. That talent is something that can be developed and technical skill can be learned, but taste seems like a kind of a ephemeral sort of thing that's difficult to quantify. So I don't know where I go from here, except maybe I should have, maybe if somebody could come up, like knows enough about like formulas, if we could make this into a formula, it might be a good thing. I don't know. But the general theory of creative relativity I'm presenting, at least today, is the association between a known and an unknown, between a variable and a constant, the unexpected association is the act amplified by the enthusiasm we feel for a new idea, by the juice that we feel for a new idea, all of that over like to the third power, using like as a metaphor, using like as a summary, and using like as an aesthetic judgment. So that's it. I don't know if that's if it adds anything to anything, but it's kind of fun to think about. And if anybody has a booking band or any other question, I'll be glad to I don't know where I am on time, but I'll be glad to take it. I hope it was an interesting little trip. Thank you. What time is it? Is anybody out there? Okay. Does anybody have any questions about anything we're talking about over there?
All right. I got a couple bands.
All right.
Pillow Talking Heads.
Very nice.
Paul Revere and the Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Well, wait a minute. Now, where in what universe is Raiders of the Lost Ark a book?
You said movies.
I did not.
Yes, you did.
It's the title of a book. Well, go ahead. Go ahead, Chris.
I got good ones here.
All right. Keep going.
E.T. Rex. All right. Anyway.
All right.
So, I wanted to zoom in on the part about the constant, because when you talked about this before, you said that you kind of modeled it as matching kind of like your database in your head, matching these two things together.
Right.
And I actually thought of it, and I thought what I was doing is thinking of a bunch of different band names and then sensing momentarily, like, does this band name feel like it has the potential to match up with some movie name out
there?
And so it wasn't like I was matching it up against a bunch of movie names. I would make the decision about the band name based on the sensation that I had that this was going to work out eventually.
But you were like doing it. You were like, is this going to be fun? Like, should I go down this road because this one might be funny?
But
when you came to T-Rex, for a moment you said, yes, that could be funny. And now you started shuffling through the other universe. So there's never a moment in which you did not have a constant being compared to variable.
That's true. But I guess I just wanted to delve a little just down to that level of detail where you decide not to pursue something.
Yes,
you
know, it's you're making a decision by omission.
Right, exactly. You rule something out.
Yeah.
That's all.
Yeah, yeah. It's interesting. I mean, it is interesting to evaluate that process. So, somebody else.
All right, so I've got a book into a band into a movie. So
all right,
it's an interview with a Vampire Weekend at Bernie's.
Very good.
But I've got a question. I've been to your site numerous times, and I've always enjoyed going, and especially Layer 10, the Photoshop, and even the Copy Goes Here movie. Fantastic. No, that was the first thing. I think that was my first exposure to it, so going back to that. But running the company, and you've got family mentioned, how do you manage it all? Like, do you block out a certain amount of your work week to say, all right, we're concentrating on these things to expand ourselves?
We don't have any plan about anything. I do. The only sort of structure I have at all is that I don't work at home and I don't bring home to work. So I don't live very far from the studio. So when I'm at work, I'm working. And when I'm at home, I'm home. And if I'm at home and I got to do something at work, I get in the car and I actually physically drive to the location because it helps to keep me sane. But in terms of the way that our studio works, and I mentioned this before, I don't know if I mentioned it here the last time, but the perfect metaphor for Kudal Partners is a preschool Montessori. Because the Montessori system is all about personal responsibility. And if you go to a preschool Montessori, you'd be freaking amazed at how quiet and diligent the little kids are. And everybody's responsible for their own things. And things need to get done, but we're small enough that there's nowhere to hide. So we sort of roll with it. I don't have as many customers as Jason Fried. Jason's company and my company share a space in Chicago. But, you know, he rolls with it too. Like, you follow your instincts, and certainly you have to make payroll, and you got to pay for the guy to come and clean the water the plants, or, you know, they're going to die and all that. But I mean, in terms of the way that the business develops and opportunities that come, we're purposefully without business plan, probably in our 13th year. So I don't know if that helped.
So if you've got the theory of creative relativity as like this,
I'm not going to fight really hard for it.
No, I understand. As like the idea generation and, you know, the spark in the life of creativity. So that's like the theory of relativity. And then the execution of that could be like quantum theory.
Okay? All right. I'm with you.
So and the actual, you know, nitty gritty of pulling Bezier curves around. So what's the theory of everything? Like, how do you get
isn't it 42?
Yeah. Right, 42 aside, maybe. I'm willing to accept that.
I would say that actually my idea is that this is the theory of everything, and that what you made out to be quantum theory was, in fact, just the execution of the ideas that come out of here. That's how I'll defend it. And that building the atomic bomb was not essentially different than building a Buick, if it wasn't for the theory that came ahead of
sure.
it.
Sure. So I guess what I mean is, like, you've got...
I haven't had much time to defend this thing, by the way.
I think you can do it, though. So, I mean, you've got the scientist with the idea to make the bomb, and then you've got, you know, mechanics that build the bomb.
Right.
So... is it always going to be like that, or you know, it seems like in this creative scope, you have to be the scientist that can also build the bomb.
I agree. I think you're right. I think that there is, every day goes by, more and more executional responsibility goes on the original creator, and I think that's a good thing. So
okay.
Maybe there is no theory of everything.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Jane Eyre Supply.
Jane Eyre Supply. Very nice. I saw them on a double bill with Of Human League Bondage.
One more, The Soundgarden and the Fury.
Very nice.
Speaking from someone who comes from a traditional agency, how did you first make the jump from being a bunch of guys who do graphic design and creative projects to being an organization that comes up with innovative things that are going to, you know, draw people to your site, like Copy Goes Here and things like that?
Long story, very short. We lost a bunch of clients and we were in deep shit. And nothing will get your attention faster than not being able to make payroll on Friday, not having enough money in the account on Wednesday to make payroll on Friday. So we kind of made a list of the things we had and the things we didn't have. And one thing we had was this pretty loyal and fairly large audience. And on the other side of the list, where we had these clients that were firing us for no reason of ours, just they, you know, the economy was going bad or whatever. And we said we got lucky and lost a lot of business and had to reevaluate. If that hadn't happened, maybe we would have been hiring more people and doing more crappy brochures and producing work we weren't proud of for people we didn't like. I wouldn't be speaking here if we were, that's for sure. So, but it's not all, you know, rainbows and unicorns. We sort of have to make our way through it. And, the jewel boxing thing got lucky. We started selling them. And then, you know, we also realized that we weren't that interested in growth in terms of people count, that we felt like 6, 7, 8 people is a really nice non-political size. If people work hard, there's nowhere to hide. We could sort of have the culture that we want and still make enough money to pay our mortgages and our tuition. So that was a conscious decision too. It's easy to say we don't need a lot of people and we don't need a lot of money when your clients are leaving. So,
hi, great talk. I think I mostly understood what you were saying.
You and me both, man.
The band booking thing, I really enjoyed it. My friends and I, we have done something similar, and maybe you guys could do this if you run out of books and bands. It's celebrities and animals. Such things as Sigourney Beaver. Ali Berry or Al Pacino.
See, now I'm going, let's see, rhinoceros. What celebrity is rhinoceros? So, yeah.
So, nothing really to add, just if you need more more things for the chalkboard.
More of a zoological approach, okay?
Is a booking band required to ask a question?
No.
Or, okay.
But you'll get a better answer.
Well, no, okay, fine. Well, I was a little disappointed because the first band that jumped in my head was Blink-182, and then I realized that Gladwell had kind of screwed me. And it was like, oh, I'm done.
Very That's annoying. Okay.
Yeah.
That's pretty good.
So I'm one of those guys that lives for the ignition point, and I have a question, or do you have a suggestion on for other people who don't necessarily live for it? Or for instance, like translating that ignition and that that enthusiasm for your idea, is that something that you think needs to happen, or is it just the booster rocket that gets the idea done and then the idea needs to live on its own merits? Because whether it's presenting to clients or even presenting to other designers, you know, they might not see the thing that made you stay up all night, like going 36 pixels, that's it, you know, that's the solution, you know.
So 42, I think.
Yeah, well, sorry, 42.
I don't know, like that. Like the the whole selling thing. Like you have this whole, you have to have the idea twice, you know, like you have the idea and you make the thing and then you got this whole other project, which is how do I sell the puppet? You know, so like that is like, that's totally disheartening and will eventually drag you down to submission. So, you know, find a situation where you don't have to do that all the time. I don't know. We don't, I mean, that's the thing is that, I mean, that's the, for us, that's why we're doing what we do, so that we can actually, do the work. Because there's so much crap that goes with the work in other situations that you don't have time. Like, you know, that metaphor of the guitar, bang, 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 bang. That's what we want. We want that over and over and over again. We don't care if we fail 5 times in a row because we're going to make something work in the 6th time. And even the 5 failures without the 6th redemption are valuable because we've learned something new. So, I don't know what to tell you. It's been a long time since I've been here.
All right, so I got a band too. Okay. Connecticut Yankee and King Arthur's Wolf Parade.
Right.
So my question is, before you even get to the theory of creativity and all of that, what happens when you get to a block? Like, what?
Wait a minute, I'm going to change views. These are the 10 things I learned during an office with 37 signals.
Do you have any things you use to get a brainstorm or get, you know, get the creative juice started? Because sometimes you have a project and you're just, you know, a meatloaf brand and you're just like, I can't get really excited about meatloaf, you know?
Yeah, I know. And I think, and you know, even more so than that is sometimes there's this like block where you just can't get going.
Yeah.
And one thing that we do is when we work on a creative project is that what we tend to do is that we get together and then we talk a little bit, just enough to make sure that everybody understands what's going in the recipe. And then we break apart. And we develop really rough ideas, and then we come back together and we argue. And we do it on purpose, because what it does is it forces me to do... I can't have a voice in the argument unless I got a couple of things to talk about. So it forces me, even if I'm not excited about meatloaf, to do a couple meatloaf sketches.
Right.
And so once I've done that, I'm invested in it in some way. And I come into the discussion, and maybe Susan has a beautiful meatloaf. And so we argue about that and we go that way. So I think that the collaborative part of it is really key. There's nothing, when you're blocked on a creative thing and you're by yourself, that blows. Like, because there's nowhere to go. But if you know, sometimes the trip to Conference Room B is really important. The Conference Room B being the, this little tavern around the corner from our office. And sometimes that change of environment and talking about the Blackhawks for 15 minutes before you start talking about the project again can be all that it takes to break it. So I think it's wherever you are, where it's not working, go somewhere else because it might work there, I guess.
Cool. Thanks.
I have, I think, 2. Portrait of a Lady Killer.
Oh, beautiful.
And then a Woman in White Stripes. The Woman in White Stripes.
Oh, yay.
All right.
Maybe we should open this competition up again at the office.
My general question is, I kind of like that you, not enforce, but that you encourage people to come up here with the band, the booking bands, to kind of encourage that type of inspired thinking. And I'm wondering, I have a lot of trouble encouraging collaboration in terms of the group that I work with.
How many people are in the group?
It's about 10.
How many people
it's an advertising agency. So
how many people are in the company?
Over 500.
Well, of course. Of course you do. Yes, because people are jealous of their ideas. They don't want to share them.
I guess what I'm wondering is, when you call a meeting...
Because they're ruled by fear. They're afraid. I mean, I don't know anything about your company,
but
they're probably all afraid.
But I'm a really nice person, and I'm very approachable, and...
Well, they're not afraid of you. Necessarily, no, well, maybe they are, but not necessarily. They're afraid because they're an interchangeable cog in a big machine making a ton of money for people they don't know.
But even internally, I have a lot of trouble getting people to volunteer kind of ideas. And I don't know if it's...
Is it because they don't have any?
Oh, I hope not.
No. Well, what do you think it is?
Do you do things like this with internal meetings or kind of encouraging that brainstorming?
No, I agree with Jason. Meetings are toxic. Yeah. No, we don't have meetings. Sometimes we have lunch. So that's kind of a meeting.
Bribery.
I don't know. I mean, I don't know what the answer is. I mean, it's not... 10 seems like a good number for a group to be able to collaborate together. Somebody said, maybe, I don't know who it was, somebody said, if you can't feed your team with a pizza, with two pizzas, your team's too big or something? So I don't know. I'm not big on games like playing role. As you can probably tell, we don't play little game, like little creativity games. Like people who like have to go off site somewhere to be creative, just forget it. Like if you can't, make that happen. You have to. It's got to be the other way around. You got to. It doesn't matter where you are. So I don't know. I don't know what to do. Get new people. Fire a couple of them, and everybody'll get scared, and then it'll work out great. Yeah.
Hi. So my booking band is Oh, the Places You'll Okay Go.
All right. We had one too, which was I'm Okay, You're Okay Go.
That was pretty good. So I guess my comment was actually kind of similar to hers. I was just thinking down the physics line of thought. So you have matter and you have antimatter. For every bit, there's the same amount. And when they collide, it completely disintegrates everything.
Okay.
So I was thinking, you know, maybe there's...
That's your work situation?
Huh? Well, so there's creativity and then there's anti-creativity. So, you know, with your equation, maybe you know, you take the whole thing that you said and divide that by things we can think of as anti-creativity. And you know, some things I thought that would be part of that variable on the in the denominator would be you know, like the number of rules that are set, the fear of your peers in the group, deciding, kind of coming to a point where you want to decide on one particular idea too soon before everyone's
I'd like to put company picnics in that list.
Yeah. Like, you know. Yeah, or, you know, some people have ego. They want their idea to be chosen right away. And they're like, let's move to a decision.
I'm with you. You know, and maybe there's like a Star Trek episode in it, too. So.
Yeah. And one idea that might help was we had a recent brainstorm where we were thinking of product ideas. It's for like a health application. And we're we weren't getting very many ideas, and we're like, all right, let's change it up. Let's think of the absolute worst ideas for a health application possible. And that got
bingo.
Ideas like flying.
Bingo, we got it. Yeah, that's right. Looking at things from a completely different perspective is always a good thing. Thank you.
Hello. Hi. Catch you, 22.
There you go.
And one I stole from my friend Jeff, Green Day and Ham. Which I think is actually better than mine.
That's a very good one.
I have a question for you. I was at your talk last year as well, and you talked then about how you guys record all of your ideas for products and stuff into an idea book, which is sacred and private. Mm-hmm. And you also mentioned it here a little bit earlier as well, and you scrawl on the bathroom walls, which is cool as well. But do you find that the element of frustration is kind of required to actually get people to follow through with their ideas? Do you find that even if you had an idea that was totally worth implementing, once you put it in the idea book, once you thought it through end to end, you were satisfied with the ideas, and then no one really had the urge to make it happen because the actual like thing that they're getting off on is the planning. Because I think I have that problem.
I think I have it too, and I never quite thought of it that way. But but we sort of let it go that the good stuff will out.
Okay.
Like we're okay. Like we're always abandoning things, like all the time, and we're okay with that. And I don't know what it is about the things that we don't abandon that make them different than the ones that we do.
Do those ones ever end up fully realized in your idea book? Do they ever get written down?
Generally, we don't write them in the book if we're actually doing something.
Okay.
The book is sort of like a big joke. Like, oh, here's one for the book. Like, okay. I mean, it's not a joke, but it's like, you know, like, don't you ever play that game where like, okay, here's money-making idea 7,622. Let the people of the world elect the next pope with our new social application. Oh, my God, that's great. Got any other ideas? Like, you know, like there's no, you just put it aside. So I think, you know.
So the book is more of a last resort for the
Yeah,
last
it's sort of like getting divorced and moving to Alaska. You know, it is sort of. But, you know, things have come back out of the book before. It's possible.
Like anything we'd recognize?
That goofy pin setter thing we have at our site where you could just buy a bunch of pins with letters on them to spell words. Well, that was real genius. that was in the book and came out because
did
we
do
were,
it.
Huh?
But they, you did create it and people do use it.
Yeah, we did. And so that was in the book and came out because we were ordering some pins for something else or a client thing or whatever. We said, well, let's just order a couple alphabets and see if people like this idea. So,
okay.
And they sort of do.
Cool. Got
Thank
it.
You.
Thanks.
Yeah, hello. So Matchbox 2010 Odyssey 2 Live Crew.
Very nice.
The Color Me Bad Purple. The Chemical Brothers Karamazov.
That one's on the site.
You oh, it just, is. Okay. You were worried about that because I've seen the site, but yeah.
Okay.
And I'm not sure if this one's a book, but The Bridge Over the River Jamiroquai.
That's a good one.
Okay.
I believe it was a book. I'm not sure.
Yeah. Okay. And my question is kind of about the idea of these booking bands and how they could fit into a creative process. So it sounds like you guys seem to come up with a lot of techniques like that that kind of work like brainstorming. Mm-hmm. And I kind of think of there's like that kernel of the what you're talking about with the constant and the variable.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost like you're taking that kernel out of this process and maybe you can apply it later in
right.
another design problem you're having.
Right.
And I'm wondering, does it work? Like, say you're actually at kind of a crossroads in a design problem and you're like, I need to answer and kind of running out of time, but I'd like it right now.
Mm-hmm.
Do you ever just switch into like booking bands mode or something else? And if so, does the result from that work quickly or does it take a long time? And then like, you know, like 3 weeks later, you're like, oh, that was linked and that makes sense. And now I have the answer.
I don't know. I mean, the thing about that is that deadline thing kind of trumps everything. So we all know this. Like sometimes we have the right answer and we present it and everything's great. But many times we owe it to the client Tuesday at 5. So at 3 o'clock, we go with the best thing we have. The best thing we have might not be the right thing, but by 5 o'clock, I'll have talked myself into it. You know, so yes, no, if we have the luxury of time where we can come at it from another way, I think we usually do, or sometimes put somebody new on the job. Like, that's an interesting thing. You're working and you're blocked. You can't figure out an answer. We'll give your layout to somebody else for half a day. And even if they don't finish it or solve it, they'll screw it up enough that you have to get back to work to fix it. So now all of a sudden you're in the layout and you're moving things around again. So you're working. So maybe that's it.
So I found myself while in line wondering about booking bands, the festival edition, where you start a chain going.
Oh, I like that.
It began with the cat in the hat, the cat in the men without hats, the cat in the men without caps for sale, and onwards.
Men at work and whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So I was wondering, though, as my question, as another recovering English major, if you could talk a little more about the role of failure versus perfectionism and risk-taking. G.K. Chesterton once said, if a thing is worth doing, it's worth doing badly.
That's right.
And I find that very helpful, but I was wondering if you felt that way.
Yes, I do. I'll say two quick things about it. First of all, sometimes people ask me, what's your biggest failure? And my answer always is, oh, it's a beaut. We're working on it right now.
I love it.
So that's one. And then the other thing is, it's really easy to talk things to death. So, like, if decisions are made by the path of least resistance, then you must be aware that it's really easy to talk things to death. That nature left to itself will talk ideas to death. So you need to be proactive to say, let's make this happen. Let's try this. Let's fail at this.
Do you have a way to trigger that?
No, just to recognize that, you know, it's okay to kill things and talk them to death, but don't pretend like you're doing something else. Like, you know, be okay. You know, the ideas you kill are as important as the ones you do. So, you know, it's okay. Just don't pretend that you've studied the market and this product's never going to work. Where what you're really doing is you don't want to work on it. So say you don't want to work on it and do something else. I don't know.
Thanks.
Okay, last one.
I'm sure this one's been done, but Full Metallica Jacket.
Oh, I don't think so. It's good. They're okay. Played a double bill with Megadeth of a salesman.
Yeah, absolutely. He's good. I wanted to ask if you see any connection between your theory, which I find fascinating, and the concept that I think a lot of athletes talk about with the state of flow, where you
like get in the zone.
Yeah, the in the zone thing. Because I think we've all probably experienced moments where that happens. And things continue to fire. And if you had any thoughts out ahead, how to sustain that guitar chord.
Yeah.
On and on.
I don't know, but the more you do it, the easier it becomes. Yeah. So maybe it's, you know, maybe it's just a learned thing. Maybe it's trusting your instincts more as you are more successful. I don't know. I do know that sometimes ideas come very easily and sometimes ideas don't come at all. And I don't have an answer for that. And I don't think my theory addresses that either. But it does say that my theory, listen to me, that there is a process, and recognizing the process might at least let you know what's happening. So I don't know. I mean, it is true though. Like, good work begets good work. Yeah. Like, if you do something, if you do, like, you're working for one client, you're doing some great, let's say, print layout that's inspired by some vintage typographical thing or whatever, and then you move to another client whose look and feel is completely different, and you got your head full of all these other things, it tends to spill out into something else, you know? So, I don't know, keep trying, keep going, and, you know.
Yeah, well, thank you.
Don't let the bastards get you down.
Yeah, well, and I think also, you know, the size of team that you have, too, is those ideas fire between each other and that
chain reaction. Yeah, and, you know, it's pretty quiet, though. Like, we don't have a big... Like, it's not a whole big office full of chitter chatter. We go whole days with nobody talking to anybody. Like, we're all sitting there on IM. In fact, we started a thing where we have my wife owns a catering company. And so we have this thing now on Thursdays where we have a catered lunch every Thursday, because first it brings everybody in the office, because we don't really care where you are, where you do your work, whether at home or at the office. And secondly, we all sit around for an hour and talk to each other. It's like, hey, I recognize you. You know, and he was sitting next to me for the last 3 days, but we've only chatted on IM, you know, so it's easy. So you got to find ways, I think, sometimes to foster that chat. And we get good ideas at lunch, so, and at the bar.
Great. Thank you.
Okay, welcome. Okay, last question. Booking band?
I'm too pathetic for that. Oh, I really can't. Yeah. But I do have a little comeback on the previous question about the athletes, because I do a little bit of high-level sport. When athletes want to peak and have a peak performance, what they do is, say you want to peak on a Saturday, have a big game Saturday, what you'll do is you'll train normally on Monday, very light on Tuesday, like just a walk, rest completely Wednesday, do kind of medium exercise Thursday, work quite hard for a short time Friday, and Saturday is awesome. So I'm sure the creative process is exactly the same balance. You need to back off, like you say, go sit in another room, go to another place, find another milieu, and then actually don't do anything and let it fester.
Well, maybe I should have my staff stop coming in on Saturdays and Sundays. That's nice. Thank you very much, everybody.